Welcome to the Relentless Podcast. This is my conversation with Zane Mountcastle, the founder of PicoGrid. I had a great time talking with Zane, so I hope you enjoyed the episode.
Can you give us a high-level overview of what PicoGrid does and how it started?
Yes. Let me pull up something real quick. Cool. Thanks for having me on. Sorry, it took a while to kind of get everything aligned. On a high level, PicoGrid builds a platform for autonomous systems. We help connect the different sensors, cameras, and unmanned systems with the various software systems where that information is increasingly going. We serve a range of customers, mostly in the military, the Army, Space Force, Air Force, more recently supporting some efforts in Ukraine. And do a little bit of work outside of that in sort of government adjacent spaces, especially in utilities and infrastructure. The majority of our effort is on the DoD today. I started my career right out of college doing some work for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Naval Expeditionary Warfare Center, where I was building autonomous systems and unmanned technologies. The landscape of technology was a lot less advanced than it is today. So it's definitely interesting to see that change. But yeah, that was kind of how I got into this world in the first place.
Yeah, I don't know. I definitely enjoyed like researching you, but there is not very much stuff. There's not very much stuff out there. What did you do like directly before PicoGrid?
Yeah, I was out of college. While I was in college, I was working with some guys who eventually became, or one of the guys who eventually became my co-founder for PicoGrid, and we were building some unmanned systems technology. Just for a research project while we were in college that was picked up by a team from the Army Corps of Engineers. They reached out to us and said, hey, look, this is really interesting technology. We ended up winning a contract with them and spent a few years right out of college doing that. Sort of spun up a small LLC and technically I was a contractor for the Army Corps in the process. So we did that for a couple years and it was really, spent a lot of time with some of the least sexy jobs in the military. These are folks who manage training ranges and military installations and, a lot of jobs that people don't even realize are out there. Those are the people that I spent a lot of time with and kind of got to understand the challenges they had in just their everyday life. And just from my perspective, I'd often ask them, you know, why don't they make their lives easier, right? There's so much obvious application for better technology in their lives. And this wasn't really from the perspective of starting a company. This was just more of a curiosity, right? You spend enough time in a 4x4 with somebody, and you kind of get to know them pretty well. Did that for a while. And the technology that really, that PicoGrid is really based on is solving a lot of those problems, especially solving on the infrastructure layer, the challenges that, you know, I saw again and again and again in different contexts and in different challenges and different problem sets, but the same, you know, infrastructure is really missing out there.
Oh, that's actually really cool because I didn't realize that you had basically this seems like a natural transition doing PicoGrid if you just started out working with the U.S. military, right?
Right.
Okay. What is the most unexpected thing you've learned so far while building PicoGrid?
Yeah, one of the interesting applications that we're working on right now is enabling standoff UAV operations. So you can think of how, say, Predator drones are operated on the other side of the world, well, making that possible for small UAVs. The use case there is we have some folks that are working within Ukraine who are using our technology, but also in parallel using many unmanned systems technologies for a range of operations that they're doing sort of day-to-day. Those operators are very skilled users who they don't want to put as close to the front line as they have to when you're talking about basically telemetry range, which is where they have to put them. And if those operators could actually be using controlling those UAVs remotely, it would fundamentally change how they're operating as a fighting force. And that's, you know, one of the interesting applications that we're working on is making that possible, using the pipes that we've set up as infrastructure and supporting a couple different UAV protocols that make
is that your newest possible product that you're building now?
So it's not really a product, it's more of an integration. And kind of the way that we operate is you know, we have these core products, but it's really built around our API. The API is, you know, as we see it, is kind of the core of the system. Obviously, it's kind of the least sexy part of the entire system, right? You can't look at it, you can't touch it. It's an API. But what the API does, it acts as a data aggregation platform for all these different inputs and outputs. And why that is useful is it enables us to build integrations for different hardware systems. In this case, the drone is that hardware system, but so is a visual camera or a thermal camera or a radar system or software-defined radios or microphones or sort of whatever end effect you require for a specific mission set. Those are just integrations into the broader platform. For us, hardware is kind of a way for us to actually access these areas, right? It's a way for us to deploy those systems where we need to. But kind of the value of the system comes from allowing us to pull that data from those devices that are deployed in the field and push that data where it needs to go, right? Whether it's to a human interface, to a software system, to some other sort of devices. That's kind of where we are.
So is the reason why you built the lander basically to create a piece of technology that, you know, like the surveillance, did it just not exist? And so you had to build the technology so that you could build the API or use the API?
So I think when people say, look, I'm going to deploy a camera in the desert, right? It seems like an easy thing until you actually get down to it. Like, it's actually not a very well-solved problem. And like, there are solutions to this problem, right? We didn't like invent anything to create lander. We did just produce, we made it possible to actually do this at larger scale. And we produce the hardware systems that allow us to deploy these systems where we need to deploy them, when we need to deploy them. And so it just opens up the problem sets that you're able to solve really dramatically, right? Because you control that physical layer. And we're not building the cameras with the devices the class of technology we solve in that sense is called ISR, intelligence surveillance reconnaissance systems. And we don't build those ISR systems. Those operate as payloads or integrations into the broader platform. And we'll swap those out depending on the mission. We have a couple ones that we sort of support standard now, and that's growing kind of over time. But you know, those are built by companies and people way smarter than me that have been doing this for a lot longer than I have. And there's no reason, you know, we should be reinventing the wheel there. You know, the real problem set is not the sensors themselves, it's actually deploying them. And Lander was really built to solve a specific set of challenges, especially around military training ranges and sort of longer term installations that, you know, is just very difficult to solve without having that physical infrastructure for the power, the communications, and the compute you need to deploy any of those systems where you need them in the field.
Okay. And that just solves the problem in one simple package that you can just deploy anywhere. Right. Okay. Right. And I saw that there's like a little Starlink and a bunch of solar cells and stuff on there.
So I mean, Starlink is one of those communications mechanisms. We've actually used plenty of different ones in the past. Starlink has become a very common one, just because it works very well and it's just very ubiquitous. But that's just a communications link. It's not really the core product.
Okay. So you, I think, started this company in El Segundo. Can you explain what makes El Segundo special and why you located your company there?
Yeah, actually, I started it just before COVID hit, which was kind of a not a good time to be starting a company. But, you know, it was operating mostly out of my bedroom for a while. And then we ended up moving into one of the event spaces by Common Space Brewery, which is sort of a watering hole for SpaceX in Hawthorne, just up the street from where we are now. We were there for a while during COVID, and it was a funny place to be. I think our logo is still on the door there, just because the sticker we use is really hard to get off. So it's a bit of legacy there. Then we moved into our current factory here in almost a year ago, last February. And that's here in El Segundo on Main Street. And the community in El Segundo has been really excellent. We're that far away. We're about 10 minutes up the road in Hawthorne, you know, before. So it wasn't that far away. But, you know, I think in the past year or so, El Segundo has become a very special place. You know, there's a lot of really interesting companies and like very, very serious people building really cool technologies kind of across the spectrum, right? I think we all like to put our labels on it and call it some kind of similar thing, but you know, people are building everything from nuclear technology to manufacturing and sort of casting technology, you know, cloud seeding. Like, these are all very, very, very different things. Like, the only thing that really connects all of us is building things in the real world. And I guess that's unique enough to make a community. And, so it's, you know, it's been really interesting to see, and it's really picked up a lot of steam. Like, there's a lot of people, who are, you know, considering or planning to move to El Segundo. There was at a breakfast at this place called Wendy's, which is kind of a local breakfast spot here in El Segundo.
Okay.
Show up
not,
there.
Not the fast food like, chain.
No, it's called Wendy's okay. Place, technically. Okay. It's not a fast food chain. It's a real cute little diner, right around the corner from our office. And it's sort of a go-to spot for a lot of the founders in this area, and show up there just separately. There's like three other of the El Segundo founders, and then two guys who are in town because they're considering moving their company to El Segundo, and they just raise like a bunch of money to do so. So it's definitely, you know, it's happening faster than I really expected, but it's really cool to see.
Yeah, it is. Okay, can you walk me through the process of, was Lander your first product, or was there something before it? And how did you get your first sale for that?
Yeah. So Lander was kind of the first hardware platform we built. That was, like I was saying before, that was kind of addressing a lot of the challenges that I faced when I was building early stage sensor systems for the military at Redditor College with the Army Corps. And you know, the challenge that a lot of these people face is, look, the sensor is not really the solution, right? You can drop a really expensive sensor in the desert somewhere and it's not going to do anything, right? You have to have the power of the communications and the compute to pull that data back. So in that sense, like, that's just a fundamental starting point. If you can't solve that, anything else is useless. You know, on top, so I mean, that was kind of the first hardware system we built, but you know, you can pull that data back, and then what, right? For us to actually run large proliferated fleets of autonomous systems at scale, you need the software systems to understand that. And so that was kind of what we built, and that's what became our API, which is kind of the real core value driver of the company. But again, like, the least sexy part of the company probably. And on top of that, we built a sort of light user interface that we call Orion, which is something we actually try to actively discourage people from using, because, like, you know,
why is that?
Because the reason why is there's not one interface that's going to solve every mission, and the missions are everywhere, even on one installation. You know, people are using our technology for everything from range management operations, training operations, physical security, you know, a wide set of operations where they care about a lot of the same information, but in very different ways. And so, you know, one interface is not going to solve every problem set, as well as an interface that's pulling the data specifically for that mission need. Now, and it's in this world, it's a very controversial opinion. I think a lot of the bigger companies in this world have this philosophy of own the interface. And I mean, from a business perspective, that's probably the smartest thing to do. But from a user perspective, it's probably not, especially when you're trying to scale across really diverse mission use cases. And you know, for us, we'd rather have our data pulled in via our API into existing interfaces for very, very specific needs. And also, you know, like, one thing we're actively encouraging is for companies to start building on API, right? To start building interfaces for specific mission needs. And we actively encourage that. We'd actually very, very, we definitely prefer that over, you know, having to maintain our own interface. And we're very eager to help people doing that. And, you know, I think it's one thing that's going to start happening in the next year or so is companies start to do that and, you know, leaning on our API as that sort of data source, but making very, very, you know, excellent interfaces and use cases and software systems on top of that.
Okay. What do you think is going to be possible in the next few years that people aren't expecting or they don't know about?
Yeah. I guess from my little bubble, you know, what I see is a lot of a sort of an insane amount of investment going into this industry that for a very, very long time was essentially devoid of it. And, you know, I think the first order effect is, yes, we're going to just have a lot of companies in this space. That's good. But I think kind of where we're moving to is a world of low cost, high volume, attritable systems that all need to be networked at some layer. Now, what does that actually mean in terms of the second order effects of that now that exists? Then what, right? And that's kind of where I see this industry moving. And it's one of those problem sets that the large primes are really not structurally set up to solve, right? They're built on solving services, and services are best suited for large, really complex systems. And if you can solve the same problem with a, you know, $100 quadcopter as you could do with a, you know, $1 million large UAV, that small quadcopter is going to win every time. Doesn't matter how complex a large system is, right? I mean, even if the solution is that a quadcopter has a, you know, 1 in 10 shot of actually solving that problem, well, you throw 10 of them, right? And you're still, you know, however many orders of magnitude at a lower cost. And that's kind of the world we're going into. And that's not because the large primes are saying, okay, sure. It's because like that's the world in which, you know, conflicts are moving. And we have to understand that. And I think the conflicts in Ukraine are really a forcing function for a lot of this technology. I think it's been a forcing function for a lot of the private investment, where we realize history is not over. You know, as much as everyone in this world really, really does not want war. It is a unfortunate part of a lot of the world out there. And, you know, if that starts, you know, I sure as shit want to win that. And, you know, we have to build the technology to make that possible. And we're just simply not there yet. And that's not a controversial opinion. Like, that is actually a very, very widely accepted opinion in the Pentagon today, is that the technology we have is just simply not fit for that. You know, we keep trying to fight the lost war. But I think Ukraine's really waking the world up to the fact that, you know, any future conflict is not going to look like that. It's not going to look like the last war. It's going to look like more like Ukraine, or even more so, you know, even more aggressive than what's about happening in Ukraine. And we have to be prepared for that. And we just simply aren't today. So that's kind of the world that we're moving into. And, you know, that's one of the big, big trends I think is going to shock a lot of people.
Okay. Yeah. Would you expect, I didn't really have this question, but would you expect, like, how, if you say, think of 2030, what does a war look like at that point in time?
It looks like very few people actually in the field and actually operating in conflict. What it looks like more is large fleets of unmanned systems. And unmanned systems, I think people automatically go to drones, and that's one class of unmanned systems. There's also stationary sensors, camera systems, satellites in space, other autonomous robotics on the ground and in the seas. Like, these are large fleets of machines. And that's the world that I think a lot of military is going to. Now, of course, the soldiers are very, very important for this entire task. But I think they're going to be supplemented, you know, 100-fold. For every soldier, you're going to have 100 machines. And that's kind of the space that we're moving into.
Yeah, I saw a video on Twitter earlier today of someone, you know, trying to run around a tank, and a drone just followed them and then blew them up, which was, yeah. I was like, that's why I don't want to be a foot soldier. Yeah. Anyway, okay. So what are some other ideas? If you, like, I know that you said that you just kind of like created a LLC with your buddy, and that kind of led into PicoGrid, but what are some of the other ideas you considered working on before you started PicoGrid?
I didn't really. I mean, I think kind of stepping back, when I was in high school, a friend of mine asked me, you know, Zane, what do you want to do with, you know, when you grow up? I told him I want to work for myself. And he was very unsatisfied with that answer, because, I mean, he was looking for like doctor, lawyer, engineer, and like, I don't know, whatever would make me like be able to work for myself. That was kind of what was exciting me and what drove me. And so, you know, I was just doing some work I thought was cool when I was in college, honestly. Had the opportunity to go spend a couple years, you know, doing this like as an independent contractor for the military. Thought that was a lot of fun. I was sort of fortunate enough to not graduate with any student debt, so I had the ability to kind of go mess around for a couple years. And I did. It was certainly not the best financial move out there, but it was, you know, I think in hindsight, it was definitely worth it. And then PicoGrid was really like a sort of continuation of that, right? It was solving problems for a lot of the same customers and a lot of this in a different way, but, you know, for a lot of the same problem sets that we were targeting early on. And so I mean, it wasn't really like a conscious decision. It was more of, these are problems that need solving. For whatever reason, these problems are not solved, even though they seem insanely obvious. Let's go take a stab at it. And that's kind of how it started.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Okay. So you used to do a lot of photography. Did that have any influence on your decision? Or at least I think that you did, because I saw on your Facebook there was like a bunch of photos of South Africa. So did that have any influence on you starting PicoGrid? And actually, what was behind those photos?
Yeah. I mean, photography for me has been like sort of a hobby for a while. You know, I guess the way that I look at it is like, I just got always been interested in sort of understanding and documenting the world around me. Which I think is less so important for the technology that I'm building, but more so important for just starting a company more generally, right? You kind of have to just keep your eyes out. You know, we run into problems every single day where there's better products that could be built for those use cases, right? Like the, you know, I don't really subscribe to the mentality that like all the best products out there are already built. Like they really aren't. I mean, we've been saying that for the last 100 years, right? That all the best tools are already built, and every year, you know, people are building, you know, better and better tools for, you know, niches that in hindsight always seem obvious, right? So I mean, it's just a matter of like just like being conscious to that, being aware of that, and sort of questioning the, you know, what's out there. And I guess in that sense, sort of it sort of has informed how, you know, informed the journey for starting a company, and I mean really just sticking with it for long enough to see some glimmers of success off in the distance.
Yeah. So you just like wanted to work for yourself and were unsatisfied with like what's necessarily exists today. Is that kind of correct?
Sort of. Yeah. I mean, I have it's funny. I work with the military. I'd be the absolute worst soldier. I have sort of instinctual inability to respect authority. And that's always been the case ever since I was little. To my detriment most of the time. You know, that was kind of my driving force. And I know people have different incentives. You know, so for some people it's money, for some people it's working on really complex technologies. I mean, it's just, I don't know, doing what I want to do. And I think I found a good way to do that.
Yeah. Why do you think you have like the desire to obey authority?
I haven't heard that, the desire not to obey authority.
Okay. Yeah. Right, that doesn't sound like a founder at all.
I have sort of an inability to respect and sort of listen to authority. And, yeah, it's just like sort of like an instinctual thing. You know, it is what it is. But I think, you know, that kind of mindset is important for starting a company, because if you just kind of listen to, hey, like everything's solved, I'm just going to make something that's solved like, you know, 10% better. It's like, you're probably not going to really change much out there. You have to really kind of look at things really aggressively from first principles and, you know, go into something like the US military and say, hey, look, this is broken. Well, I've been doing this the same way for the last, you know, 400 years. How is this broken? Well, there's better ways to do things, right? And that's, I mean, not to their discredit, right? I think there's a lot of amazing things that are being built out there, but, certainly not everything is solved. And this goes far beyond just the military, right? This goes to really every industry. There's a lot of problems out there that need to be solved and are being solved by a lot of companies out there.
Would you say that the military may actually be one of the most, I would almost think that the more bureaucracy in an organization, the more opportunity there is, because it's so hard, because there's like a barrier to entry just to get off the starting line. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, for the military, it's not indifferent from any large organization of any size, private or public, right? It's the larger an organization gets, the more bureaucratic it gets, the slower it gets. We see this happen with, you know, startups that become sort of growth stage, that move into sort of later stage companies. They slow down. You know, we see this and every company that tells itself, like, I'll never slow down, I'll keep moving like it's day one, is like they're just lying to you. And that's more of a structure of just how networks operate, right? The more nodes are on the network, the more complex it is to make any decision, and the more complex it is, means slower things happen, right? And the incentives change as you get larger and all of that. So, you know, no organization, including the military, is resilient to that. And I think, you know, a lot of parts of the military understand that today and are really trying to bring in new technologies and new companies that can move faster, that are able to kind of, you know, build at a pace that they can't, and also the build at a pace that the large primes can't. It's just how organizations work. It's nothing unique to the military.
Does PicoGrid operate on the cost plus model, or is it just simply it almost sounds like you're just trying to build a API company?
So we operate on a firm fixed price model. On cost plus. So firm fixed price is basically how any products are sold, you know, in the rest of the world, right? Which is, this is how much the product costs. You can decide you want to buy it or not, right? That's how it works, versus a cost plus, which is, you're going to pay me for, you know, X number of labor hours work plus materials plus some, percentage on top of that that we capture as profit. And so, you know, in the fixed price model, you're taking the risk. And where that can pay off, though, is because you're taking that risk in terms of pricing and in terms of building technology ahead of time versus waiting for somebody else to pay for the R&D, you can squeeze out much, much higher margins out of that, right? Margins that make sense to become sort of a larger scalable business. On the flip side, the cost plus is a very low risk game. And there actually are some problems and some problem sets that I think actually are a good fit for the cost plus model, right? Which I guess is a controversial opinion in the tech world. For certain things that are extremely extremely complex, extremely unproven, you cannot accurately estimate the cost of a system. So either you way, way overestimate that, or, I mean, the reason why the cost plus model exists is in theory to save the taxpayer money, where you're only paying, you're paying a fixed percentage fee on top of the contract, and you're basically paying for as many labor hours as it takes to develop that. Right. And in theory, the incentive, the goal is to make those reduce the number of labor hours as much as possible to hit a certain set of requirements. In practice, like, the incentives are drag it out as long as you can. And that's what ends up happening, because that's how companies make more money.
Yeah, that's the problem that I have really thought about, is like, just having bad incentives makes it very difficult to, get an outcome that you're looking for.
Yeah.
How do you think PicoGrid is going to become a $10 billion company?
I think we become a $10 billion company when we make it possible for 100 billion dollar companies to be built on our technology. 100 new entrants to this space, serving hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts every year, using technology that we can help build, right? Building that core infrastructure to support these companies so they can focus on what they do best. Right, whether what they do best is building the best sensor systems or cameras or radars or drones or whatever that is, right? Building the best tool for the job, and we're basically providing that network between them that allows them to move much faster, allows them to access areas, because we've already gotten the security approvals, we already have the customers to make that possible. The customers already trust the system. They're already using it day to day for their operations. It's just one more node on the network, right? We sort of solve that friction and make it possible for these companies to really thrive. I think that's what gets me excited, right? That this industry is just simply so large that we think of, maybe there'll be $1 or $2 billion companies. There's going to be hundreds. Right? We're talking about an industry that spends $800 billion a year, and that's just in the U.S., right? This is a huge, huge industry. Taking even a fraction of that and going towards smaller players, you're going to have hundreds of billion-dollar companies, and that is something that routinely surprises people. Like, it's back of the napkin math, right? It's very simple. You just have to really look at it from first principles.
Yeah. What other customers do you think you're going to have long term outside of like military applications?
Yeah, the technology we solve is kind of in the industry term is command and control, is kind of the class of technology we solve. And that's a problem that's acute in the military, right? Understand what's going on in the field, responding to it. But it's a problem that we see in other industries as well. We have some work in wildfire sort of surveillance and operations up in Northern California. Very similar problem set, slightly different enemy. The wildfire itself, you still want to know where it is. You still want to know how to respond to it. We have a bit of traction, a bit of work in the utility space, helping them understand and respond to some of the problem sets as well. And as we expand, those are sort of areas that we'll move into. But I think for the near future, we're very focused on sort of the DoD. And if we can prove it out in this world, we can definitely prove it out in the commercial world. It's just sort of a matter of time.
Does it almost give you like a badge of like credibility to be working with the U.S. government?
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, you tell someone, hey, look, this is the military uses this technology, you sort of jump that first hurdle, which is just getting them to trust you in the first place. And actually, kind of ironically, the DoD is increasingly interested in technology. It also has commercial applications, as commercial customers as well, right? And that's, they look at it as dual use technology. And so if you can say, hey, I have some amount of revenue coming in from the commercial space, it adds a layer of credibility. And so like the sort of marketing exercise works both ways, and one sort of supports the other. Now, I'd caution a lot of people against very aggressively going after both, because you're basically running two fully separate sales organizations across the different commercial and DoD customers, or commercial and government customers. They just operate in very, very different ways, and they have very, very different requirements. But if you can nail one, you could probably nail the other. Especially if you nail the DoD, you can definitely go to commercial afterwards.
Okay. So you said that there's going to be hundreds of billion-dollar companies. Do you have any advice for founders that are considering building things in the physical world instead of just pure software?
I mean, I think the answer is just do it, right? I think it's counterintuitive, and I think for the last, I don't know, like a couple decades, it's sort of fallen out of fashion for whatever reason. But, you know, I think we're seeing this sort of renaissance, and I don't like the term deep tech. I don't like the term hard tech. Like, it's just, I think they're too restrictive in terms of how they operate. But just in terms of building things in the real world, you know, it's this broader sort of space of defense industrialism has just been so untouched by a lot of technology that there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. I think you have to go in with sort of without the hubris that, you know, technology is going to solve every problem, because it really isn't. Like, you know, it's very easy to say technology is going to do everything. I think it's just important to listen and understand where the real problems in the space are, and how, you know, I think the truth is, a lot of the time, really simple software can be the difference between making, like, really upgrading these systems and making them much more efficient. But I mean, I'd say do it. Like, don't make it a research project. Do it for as little as you possibly can. But I think the companies that exist in the real world have a sort of structural advantage, and it will be much, much larger than even the largest software companies are today. In the next, you know, 10 or 20 years, I think we'll look back and I think a lot of these companies that have received a lot of the private investment over the last decade will look really, really small in comparison. They're not going to be small companies for sure. Like, a lot of them are going to grow and become very large. But I think compared to the companies in industries that operate with the physical world, you just have simply more market out there that you can capture. Even if it's harder, I think it is certainly harder, but I think it's worth it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm kind of interested. I don't know a whole lot about how you sell to the government, but you seem to have just gotten like a massive contract from the Pentagon. Can you explain how you got that?
Yeah, so PicoGrid was a recipient of the $950 million JADC2 IDIQ. That's a large program out of the DoD that kind of spans really every service and every program, where the concept is basically connecting existing defense systems together and helping make them operate more seamlessly as a single unit. That's the larger concept. Obviously, it gets a lot more complex than that. So PicoGrid is one of a handful of companies that are on this contract, and, you know, including a lot of the companies that I think everyone would recognize, right? The Lockheed Martins, the Raytheons, the L3Harris's. Those kind of companies, and I think we're by quite a wide margin the smallest and youngest company to be part of this larger contract. What is it? An IDIQ is, it stands for indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity, where that basically means it's sort of like a bucket where the DoD can kind of make task orders up to that $950 million ceiling, which are then bid on by these other players. Certainly a big milestone for the company.
In John Coogan's video, you said that the DoD is kind of more willing to buy from like smaller players now. Why do you think that is? What changed their strategy?
Yeah. I mean, I wish I had a good answer for that. I really don't know. I think it's just been less so than a sudden change. You know, I think it's one of those things that's really gradual and all at once, right? Where for a long, long time, the kind of state-of-the-art in military technology has just not really, you know, gone far beyond the 90s. And I think there's a reason for that, right? In the 90s, there was this consolidation of defense. Like, they famously call it the Last Supper, where a lot of technology companies in this space were brought down to the handful we know today. Now, I think at the time, it was done with good intentions, right? It was done with the intention of consolidating a space, you know, reducing defense budgets, because at the time it looked like you know, a lot of the conflicts of the you know, the current era were over, and we just don't want to support, you know, a huge industry defense companies, so it only makes sense to consolidate. That was the intention. Now, I think the downstream unintended effect of that was you basically created a government sanctioned oligopoly that controls some 80% of contracts. And what do oligopolies do? They don't innovate, right? It's not a defense-specific thing. It's just how industries operate. If you don't give them any incentive to innovate because there's very little competition, and you just keep increasing and giving these companies contracts for, you know, bloated model, there's no reason not to do that. And so that's what happened, right? And I think for a while, you know, say early 2000s, that difference was obvious, but I think it was easy enough ignored because I mean, 10 year behind technologies, it's not fun, but it's, you know, you can handle it. I think by the time, you know, like 2015, 2020 came around, you know, we're operating on technology that's 20, 30 years out of date. The military is barely getting their hands on cloud technologies that have now penetrated every industry in the entire planet. And, you know, we're sure looking around at ourselves, like, why are we so far behind, right? You know, the technology that these service members are using at home, you know, going on their smart TV that has more intelligence than the greatest systems they use in day to day, is frankly embarrassing. And like that dichotomy got so large that we have to start shuffling things. And I think we have to realize that large primes, because of just how they operate, are not really suited to solve these problems. And I'm not to say not to really knock them. I think like they have actually, I think one of the narratives in this world is that a lot of these large primes have bad engineers, and they just don't, right? They have actually very, very good engineering, and they're working on a lot of really amazing technologies that are really, really critical for the national security of the country. They just simply are. But I think like these are structural problems that they're just not fit to solve. And you kind of need a new generation of companies to come up and solve these problems. And that's, I think, what we're seeing now. And we've had enough smaller successes in this world that there's less and less resistance to new companies really making headway. And that's, I think, what's increasingly opened the door. And it's sort of a self-fulfilling cycle, right? As a couple companies make success and a couple more companies are going to get contracts, and then they're successful and a couple more companies get contracts. And it's sort of a natural flywheel effect. And I think we're at the beginning stages of that now. And that's, I think, what's really going to accelerate over the next, you know, decade or so, as a lot of these companies really, really come to maturity.
So is it like in the 90s this oligopoly gets formed, and then did they just stop like putting money towards, I know that the number kept on going up for like the total defense budget, right? But did the money just get siphoned towards a specific few and kind of the spigot gets turned off for small guys?
Basically. Yeah. And that was basically the concept of the Last Supper, which is, you know, hey, if you don't consolidate, you're going to die. So link up with your buddies, consolidate into you know, a few companies. And they essentially do that, where they basically cut off the spigot to smaller players in the defense space, which I think was, in hindsight, a huge mistake. I know it was done with really good intentions, but in hindsight, it was definitely a really big mistake. And certainly reduced competition, and reducing competition reduced the innovation and sort of the incentive to build anything too far beyond the state of the art. Save for, you know, a couple of like very specific, you know, programs and efforts, which are, you know, there's a lot of really good engineering efforts out there, but on net, it's certainly slowed down.
Who do you think has the most advanced, like the most advanced military technology in the world? Like what country?
That is a very contentious question. And it's
right.
One of those things.
Just your opinion, right?
it's honestly hard to say. You know, I think the U.S. military is a very, very strong contender for that. I think there's a lot of well-known and well-documented disadvantages to the U.S. military and how they operate. But we certainly have a lot of really amazing technologies, including, you know, technologies that are announced today were really developed like a decade ago. And the best technologies of today are not public. And so, I mean, we certainly have a lot of really good technologies, but I think, you know, unfortunately, a lot of them are sort of built on sort of the last war, right? Why do we put humans in airplanes anymore? Why do we do that? Is it because of failover? Well, I mean, machines can fly things pretty well themselves right now. We cut out humans, we actually cut out the cost of the plane by a lot. We reduce the need to have human support systems, have launch ejection seats. If the systems crash, you're going to lose a lot less if there's just a machine and not a person in there. So you'll probably put them in more dangerous scenarios. You do a lot more with them. That in itself is one of those concepts that just really shakes it shakes a lot of people in the military, because that's just how it's always been done. Right? Humans have always been in planes. Why would I stop doing that? But I think as we move on, like that's just not where we're going. And those kind of technologies, especially a lot of the most advanced technologies that are out there, are built for that last conflict. And You know, it's not to say we can't build better technologies, but we just have to kind of change the way we're thinking.
Yeah, it almost sounds like that whole metaphor where, you know, you need a like a drill or whatever to put a shelf into the wall, but do you actually want the shelf, and why do you want that, you know, to hold a book, and do you even need the book, right? Just put it on an iPad. Okay.
Good analogy.
Yeah. So it's also the other thing where, you know, people buy earthquake insurance right after the earthquake, right? You know, so yeah. When California gets fucked. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. So what skill do you wish that you had developed earlier?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there's a lot, like me running a company, you kind of do a bit of everything, but I think I wish I spent more time like studying physics at like an academic level early on, where you know, I think I was a little too into like building real things, and I was kind of sort of dismissed physics as a field of study as a little too theoretical to be really practical. But in hindsight, I think it's just really, really critical for just understanding how anything works. And you know, I wish I did it a little earlier, because I think it just informs everything, like even computer systems, right? Understanding how they work at a physical level is really important for getting the most performance out of them. And if you can't ration about that, it's just very difficult to really, you know, build cutting edge technologies.
Okay. Yeah. I've actually, I never went to college, but I'm definitely going to just like study physics on my own over the next like 2 years. So what would you invite, what advice would you give to founders on how to choose a co-founder?
It's a good question. My co-founder and I were actually just talking about this the other day, because his wife is in the early stages of starting a company, and she was having the same questions. And, you know, I think the truth is just find someone you trust. Like, I think a co-founder relationship is very different from a friendship. It's a very different kind of relationship. And I think it's honestly closer to like a spouse than it is to a friendship, right? It's, you know, you're talking about building a really important thing, and you have to be able to disagree and commit on certain things. And it's not about being friends, right? It's about doing the thing that's best for the company, and knowing that you're both on the same team. And so find someone that you can do that with, right? Find someone that you can disagree and commit with, you know, 10 plus hours a day for the next 5 years. And that's, I mean, it's a very heavy thing. And I think, you know, my advice is you probably already know your co-founder. You might not know it yet, but they're probably out there. And I think just, you know, I think it's probably the hardest way to do it is to like go search for a co-founder. Right. Cause I think it takes a long time to like build that trust and build that experience. And it's certainly possible. Like, it has been done many times. And I think that's a last resort, but you probably already know someone who'd be, you know, a good fit. And I think anyone's going to have to kind of grow into the role, and, but it's definitely possible.
Yeah. I actually, and also just on a side tangent, I actually did YC's co-founder matching a whole bunch over the past like year and a half. And I have gone through probably over 30 or 40 conversations with potential co-founders, thought that I had a good one like 3 or 4 times. And holy shit, was that not correct? Like 3 or 4 weeks in, like, it's incredibly hard to know. It's really strange, because people, you know, it's very easy to get fired up in a single conversation. And then, you know, a few conversations down the line, they're not doing anything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. I think that's why I think like it's just good to know someone for a long period of time, and you can, you know, you can convince someone in any one conversation that, you know, you're a genius, you're going to work super hard, but like it comes down to it, and it's like you just don't really have that drive, and that drive is, you can't really prove it out even like over a couple of weeks, right? It takes, you know, really years to understand how somebody actually operates, and especially how they operate under pressure. Right? Everyone can be doing, you know, everyone can do good work when everything is good, but like what happens when things are not going well? Do you still show up? And that's, I think, what really matters.
Yeah, it's the whole Elon thing. What did you get done this week? Okay. So when did you first think about becoming an entrepreneur, and what was your first business? I know that you had something to do with, I think like in India. I think I saw a website that was like Project Nirmala or something. Yeah.
So that was a thing out in high school. It wasn't really a company. It was more of like a project for a class. I think the first company that I started was right out of college with some of my buddies, or that was where we were serving the Army Corps. Really just spun up a small LLC for that, to serve a single contract that we had. It wasn't really like, you know, we're really trying to scale it or anything. And that was the first one. And I guess when I, you know, thought about becoming an entrepreneur, like, honestly, I hate that word entrepreneur. Like, entrepreneur is not really like a job, right? It's like, a lot of people treat it as that. Like, my job is to start businesses. Like, your job is whatever you're doing today.
Yeah.
And
it's the shit that you're eating right now, and then you'll have more shit later.
Exactly. Yeah. I think people often over glorify it. Like, it's honestly a very low, like, it should be a low status job, right? Until for very long in, like, you're always dealing with like the worst fire that's happening at all times, and you're probably going to be blamed for it, and it's your job to fix it, depending on what that is, which changes sort of like four times a day. So, you know, but I think like the broader question of, you know, when did you want to start a company? Ever since I was like in high school, I just wanted to work for myself. So I think that was like the broader motivation, but like that takes different forms, right? It's not necessarily starting a company. I think, you know, when I had this chance right out of college to spin up this LLC, it's pretty clear, like, there was the best thing to do at the time. Certainly the most interesting thing to do at the time, like, had offers for like some regular software engineering roles that I just wasn't really excited about. And probably would have been a better financial move, but, you know, water under the bridge.
I think today it's maybe not, but
yeah, maybe not. But I mean, at the time, like, everything's clear in hindsight, right? And so, but then I think, you know, when, you know, I was sort of tossing around the idea for starting Pico Grid, and, you know, I'd spent enough time with these people in the field that I'd seen the same problems manifest in so many different ways, the same similar, like, fundamental problems, that I knew there was something to be built there. I didn't know exactly what it would look like. I didn't know exactly how it would, manifest, but I'd seen the same problem so many times that I knew there was something there. And I think that was, a clear enough signal to start a company for me, because I just seen it sort of firsthand.
Yeah, this actually kind of reminds me of Tony Zhu from DoorDash, where he just worked in a bunch of like small businesses growing up and like seeing his mom and stuff, and then like recognizing some inefficiencies in small business. What do you look for in potential hires, and what would you like future applicants to know?
Yeah, I think for me it's curiosity is one of those innate skill sets that's really hard to manufacture. Right? You can learn any tool set, you can learn you know, a lot, but if you just don't have that innate curiosity, you're probably not fit for a smaller startup. And that's, I mean, doing things outside of class or doing things outside of work, it's having passions. It's whether that's, you know, directly related to whatever your job title is, right? Just doing something that, you know, shows curiosity more than just, you know, paying the bills. I think for a startup, it's really important, and to just avoid pigeonholing yourself. You know, I've seen this a lot, interviewing however many, you know, engineers at this point. There's a lot of engineers who are very, very tied to their specific field, right? I only do, you know, low level C embedded programming. It's like, okay, well, have you considered anything else? It's like, no, I haven't. That's what I do. And that's just, I mean, For a lot of industries, that's actually the correct answer, right? Like, you want someone who's a very, very deep specialist at one specific thing, and that's what they're going to do day in, day out for the next 10 years. That's not how a startup works at all, right? It's like, you know, you're going to be flopping between writing embedded C to, you know, writing cloud applications, to writing web applications, to, you know, debugging, you know, network problems. Like, these are, and they're all going to be the same day, right? And so you have to be, you know, the way that I look at it is like engineering is engineering, right? It's, you can have your specializations, and I think the specializations are good, but a good engineer is just a good engineer, and they're going to figure out a way to solve it no matter what the problem set is. You know, one of our software engineers, he actually started his career as an aerospace engineer working on propulsion systems at SpaceX, like fully like mechanical systems. These are like not hardware, not software systems at all. And he ended up basically having to pick up software engineering just purely out of necessity. Like, it was what was needed for the job. And And now he's you know, one of the best software engineers I know. And it was just because you kind of take it from that first principles perspective and you pick up a new tool set, but it's still built on the same, you know, curiosity and just being a good engineer. And that applies for other sort of fields of work as well, like designers or, you know, BD people or whatever it is. Just like, you know, it comes down to really like first principles thinking, which is it's really, really hard to teach, unfortunately.
Yeah, I actually, I think it's kind of like the skill set of just understanding that companies don't build themselves and being willing to do whatever task is required to get, you know, to the next stage of evolution, yeah, whatever that is. So it's kind of like being a generalist that's good at context switching and is curious, a little bit like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So final question, what is the most difficult thing you've ever had to overcome?
I mean, I think like building a company is just really hard, and that's probably, you know, I'm certainly not done with it, and certainly have a very, very long way to go before I'd consider myself even remotely successful. But I think it's just a really hard thing, and you just continuously get punched in the face by, you know, from every angle, right? Whether it's product or, you know, sales conversations fall through, or, you know, just everything, or, you know, hires you get really excited about that, you know,
you just decline the
offer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, these things happen all the time. And it just like, sometimes it gets really hard. Like, especially when you have a couple of those like losses stack up in a week. You know, sometimes you just gotta like go home, go to sleep, wake up the next day, feel fresh and kind of go on. And you know, I was listening to this interview with Jensen Huang, the founder of NVIDIA, where he was talking about, you know, they were asking like about starting NVIDIA, and he was just saying, look, it was just really hard. Like, it's just fundamentally really hard. And if I knew how hard it would be going in, I probably wouldn't have done it. Right. Yeah. I don't know if I feel that strongly about it. Like, you know, I still have fun with what I'm doing and I still enjoy it, but it certainly gets hard sometimes, right? It certainly does. You know, you just got to kind of, sometimes you just got to like take the punches and then move on.
I did actually have one other question because I thought of this while we were talking.
Sure.
I saw on a job application that you guys are profitable at like $5 million in revenue. How did you manage that?
Spending less than we make.
Like, this is such a rare thing in startups, is actually being profitable, yeah, at that such low revenue, yeah, base.
No, it's funny. You know, I think there was this interview with Gabe Donicello, who's the founder of Umbra Space, who's actually one of our investors, actually in our most recent round. And you know, I think so. He operates a company, Umbra, that does SAR imagery for, mostly for the government, so that's satellite imagery, but synthetic aperture radar. So mostly in terms of, instead of like visual imagery, it's sort of topography is an interesting way to look at it. Anyways, basically he built the company on very sound principles where, you know, I'm going to spend less than I make, and I'm going to make sure the unit economics of every satellite, of every image, are positive. And you know, they raised a lot less money than any of their competitors. They've certainly a lot less glory and a lot less spend than their competitors. But they found out a better way to do it. Right. And I think a lot of it's just like building a fundamentally better company. And it's definitely something I aspire to. Right. It's at some point, there was this, I think it was like a TechCrunch article that I think was written as like a targeted, you know, like takedown article of Gabe, but, this is a direct quote that he's unreasonably obsessed with unit economics. And I'd love to be described as unreasonably obsessed with unit economics one day. I think if I am, I think that'd be a very, very big success. And so, I mean, we're definitely not, you know, printing cash, but like we are, you know, break even and actually have been for quite a while at this point. And I intended to continue that, but I think in this industry, it's really important. Like, there's a lot of, it's a lot of big swings and you cannot be dependent on anyone, coming through. So, you know, just build a company, don't burn too much money. It's certainly possible. And like, yes, this includes building hardware systems. That always blows people's minds. Like, it's definitely possible.
Yeah, it was so cool to see that, because, you know, in my mind, when I see someone that's actually somehow managed to build something profitable, I'm like, okay, there's a much better likelihood that they actually build up an enduring company versus something that's right. just kind of a flash in the pan, 2 years, grows like crazy and dies. So,
right. yeah.
Anyway, it's okay. Well,
it's definitely something I try to you know, prioritize as much as possible.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this was awesome. Thank you so much, Zane.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming on.